Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Following Margaret Atwood's widely acclaimed Madam trilogy, The Heart Goes Last is a very funny and disturbing novel about a new future in which the lawful are locked up and the lawless roam free. Charmaine and Stan, a poor couple living in their car, sign up for a social experiment which seems to offer a new life in suburban paradise with turbulent consequences. Margaret Atwood is the author of more than 40 books of fiction, poetry, and critical essays, including Cat's Eye, Alias Grace, The Handmaid's Tale. She's been shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize 5 times, winning in 2000 with The Blind Assassin. This edition of The Book Show is in partnership with the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts, recorded before a live audience in the Gamble Auditorium on the campus of Mount Holyoke College. They will join me in welcoming Margaret Atwood to The Book Show.
Talk a little bit about how this book came about, because it is unusual in the sense of the way it came to be, going back to a very old form of an installment novel. How did that come to you, and was it always your intention to broaden it and to publish it as a full novel?
All right, so the story it actually has two origins, and one of the origin stories is why I was interested in this kind of material, but the other origin story is how I came to write it. And I came to write it online on a site called Byliner, which I think has since been swallowed up. We're in the predatory stage of websites now. It's sort of like the Burgess Shales, you know, many strange life forms, but only some will survive. And this one got eaten by something called Vook. And I think Vook in turn got swallowed by a whale of some kind. But when Byliner was there, it was dedicated to publishing longer journalism pieces and longer short fiction of the kind that used to appear in glossy magazines. In fact, a lot of the people involved in it were glossy magazine editors. That was their background. And one of those editors had been my editor at a glossy magazine. She had a background with New York Review of Books and The New Yorker, but when I worked with her, she was working for Playboy, back before it went completely pictorial. And I noticed that it has since reversed its completely pictorial stand because it wants to get into the Chinese market. And apparently the Chinese are not so keen on female people without any clothes on. So it's gone a bit backwards in time. But meanwhile, Amy Grace, when it went pictorial, she being a word editor, moved over to Byliner and said to me, why don't we try something on Byliner because Amy Tan has. Well, that's an incentive to do just about anything. So I said, okay, because I have a subject that I've been thinking about quite a lot. So I did the first one. And that one went so well that we ended up doing 3 more. By that time, my book publisher with the covers and pages, you know, that kind, noticed what I was doing and said, Margaret, why are you doing that? In a disapproving manner. Why don't you turn this into a book with pages and covers? So I did that. It took me a while.
So when it comes to the second origin story of what you wanted to write about,
yes.
Where does that come
from?
That
goes way back, because at the center of the plot of this story, there is a prison-for-profit private scheme, and I had long been interested in the history of prisons, and where they came from in the first place, because amongst hunter-gatherers, there are no prisons. there are no prisons because there is no architecture as such. There are no permanent places that you can put people in and keep them. So I think I really started thinking about that when I was up in the Northwest Territories of Canada. Close your eyes, visualize Alaska. Okay, to the right of Alaska, which on your map is blank. There's nothing there. So in that part where there's nothing there, I was there. And I was talking to a person who grew up out on the land in the Eastern Arctic, in other words, in a hunting and gathering mode of life. And she said to me, when I was a child, there was a person in our group who went crazy and said he was going to kill all of us. And I said, Jeannie, what did you do? And she said, there were no police there. There were no hospitals. There were no prisons. And then she said, my dad took care of it. And that's what life was like before there were prisons. So prisons have an upside as well as a downside. Mm. Before there were prisons, if somebody was really a danger to the community, you had to kill them. And people studying that thing say that area say that there was, you see, moving from hunter-gatherers to agriculture, a decrease in interpersonal violence, although an increase in hierarchy. So people get less equal, but they also devise other modes of dealing with people who might be threatening them, either physically or politically.
But as you note,
yes,
the idea of a for-profit prison...
That's recent.
Yes.
It has a germ of medieval substance to it, in that people used to put highly placed enemies into their dungeons and then ransom them off. So that was a for-profit scheme of a different kind. But the for-profit schemes that we have now, I would say go back to maybe North Carolina, prison colony, before Britain and the United States separated, and then Australia, which was a similar kind of thing. And in modern times, you've got some in the United States right now, because although forced labor is unconstitutional, that doesn't apply to convicted criminals. So you, in fact, have some up-and-running for-profit prison schemes in the United States today, which are quite large. The only problem with for-profit schemes is, of course, you have to keep them full in order to make the profit. So it's an incentive, really, to create more criminals. There was a big scandal called Kids for Cash. You might have remembered that, in which judges were taking kickbacks for sentencing kids to juvenile detention because it was a for-profit scheme. But my for-profit scheme is much nicer than that. On the surface, it's much nicer. But then we have to find out how the profit is being made.
At the beginning of the novel, when this couple is living in their car and they're living in fear and they're wondering what happened and what the future is. That seems very contemporary, very real, very much a product of our downturn in 2008, 2009.
Yeah, no question. That happened to a lot of people, and it seems still to be happening. I've noticed that there's a new film that just came out called 99 Houses, which is about a man whose job it is to evict people from their houses. And another man who gets evicted by him, but then gets hired by him. So, of course, I'm going to rush off to see that. I also have something I thought I made up in my book, which is it's a reality TV show called The Home Front, in which the woman goes around interviewing people who have just been evicted, and the person with the sobbiest sob story gets money sent to them. And somebody said, doesn't that actually exist? And I don't know. You know, it seems as if it ought to. So it is very contemporary in that way. And the other thing that's very contemporary is there are a number of cities whether for-profit prisons or just prisons, a number of cities in which that is a pretty major part of the economy in that locale.
So when Stan and Charmaine see the ad for the Positon project, the selling points are what?
Oh, well, first of all, you don't have to live in your car anymore. And there's a digital tour of the house that you will live in, which has got a bed that you can lie down on and sleep in, and it's got floral sheets, and it's got big, fluffy, white towels. Remember Leona Helmsley and those ads for the towels? They really stuck in my mind, so that's my little homage. You know, big, fluffy, white towels, they're very attractive. And toilets that flush, and full employment, and just really your own lawn and everything. It's very, very appealing. If you were living in your car, you would find it appealing too.
You have to be accepted.
Yes, you apply. You are accepted. They're not accepting a lot of old people. In fact, they're not accepting any old people. So young, perky types of people are accepted in. And once they're in, they find out that they will be spending 1 month in the house that they've seen on the digital tour. And the next month, they will be prisoners in the prison, which is at the center of the town. The month after that, they'll be back in the house. And then the month after that, they'll be in the prison. So it's turn and turn about, with 50% in and 50% out at any time. Therefore, full employment for everyone. Plus, think of the savings of cost of living if you've got two couples sharing the house. Mm. Sort of the ultimate time save. There is a catch. You can't have a lot of really criminal people in there because they would be disruptive, would they not? So something has happened to them.
And you wanted to explore, because you let it go for a while till things start to go awry.
Oh, they go awry quite quickly.
Yes.
Yes, you're not supposed to meet the alternate couple who's living in your house when you're not there. But of course, that rule fails to be observed. You get a situation, something like Midsummer Night's Dream, from which there's a quote at the beginning of the mm-hmm. book, in which the wrong people fall in love with each other. Oh. And then things get squirrely.
Would the attraction, I was wondering this in reading the novel, would the attraction have happened if there wasn't in the premise this idea of a better life?
Would the attraction have happened if there wasn't in the premise the idea of a better life? Well, that's something we will never know the answer to. I think the attraction might not have happened if there hadn't been such a forbidden fruit kind of aspect to knowing your alternate couple.
When you think about these things, and again, this was done in a series, so at what point did you start to work on it to become a complete novel, and what were you able to add to it, to fill it out?
Yeah, writing as a serial, now my admiration for Charles Dickens has really increased, because that's how he wrote his early novels. But he didn't even have the benefit of any editing or hindsight at all. He was writing with his quill pen on the pages, handing the pages to the printer's devil, who would run off and get them typeset. And then these chapters would appear in groups of probably three as numbers. And if the numbers became popular, then, of course, the story went on. He was really writing on the fly. He didn't write all his novels that way, but he started that way and wrote a number of them that way. So I started thinking of it as a whole probably about episode three, but I didn't really get into making it into a whole until I was sitting down with them in front of me. And I had to take out all of the connective tissue, because when you're writing in serial form, you have to keep reminding the reader of what it was that they read last time, you know, what it is that they knew last time, because there will have been a gap between this number and that number. So I had to take that out, because if you put it into a novel, it can get very irritating. People could, you just told me that. There wasn't a beginning. So I had to pull the backstory out of the episodes and put it at the front. And there also wasn't an end. I left our hero, Stan, at the end of episode 4, dressed as an Elvis Presley sex robot and locked into a packing case about to be shipped to Las Vegas, as one would be.
Sure, right. And why would you want to go any further than that?
Well, because I took pity on him, yes. Somebody had to open that packing case at the other end. And then we had to find out what happened to him next, not to mention Charmaine, who had been left behind in dire straits. So with a serial, there is always the need for cliffhangers at the end of each episode. And I had indeed duly put those in.
Margaret Atwood is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new novel is The Heart Goes Last. I couldn't believe it's been 30 years since The Handmaid's Tale.
Yes, I know. It's kind of frightful, isn't it? So since that time, it has been a film.
Right.
It's been an opera, really a pretty good opera. It's been a ballet. It's been something people dress up as on Halloween. And it is about to be a graphic novel that will come out in 2017. What else is there?
And as far as the graphic novel, you have a part in that.
But I'm not drawing it.
Right.
No. No, it's a very good artist called Rene Nault, N-A-U-L-T. Of course, I have a part in it because it's a graphic novel of a book, so the text is based pretty firmly on the book.
What excites you about projects like that, something different?
I think it's insatiable curiosity. Most recently, I tried out something called Birdly. I did this so you don't have to. Birdly, you put a virtual reality headset on your head, and you put earphones on, and you get onto sort of platform and put your arms into basically the wings, and you can steer by going up and down. You have to flap the wings to increase your speed.
I'm now imagining you doing this.
Yes, I know. People doing it actually look pretty stupid to the people watching them do it. But meanwhile, there you are, and unfortunately what they had on view was a cruise over Manhattan. So what I was seeing was a lot of rooftops. And if you don't flap hard enough, you crash into a building. So I'm sorry to say that I crashed into a building. You can then reset, you know, and continue your cruise. And do you think this is the wave of the future?
Does that help you?
Dodging that question.
Well, I'm wondering if you, since you have referred to your writing as speculative fiction, so is that something that you use as a launching pad to say, okay, this is what happened if we integrate this into our culture, our popular culture, or is it something that you just sort of use it to?
You just never know. So, do you know what a lint brush is?
Yeah.
Yeah, you roll it over things and pieces of lint stick to it.
Sure.
Well, that's like my mind. You know, I think of my mind as this sort of rolling lint brush that picks up, you never know what, and you never know when it might come in handy. But a lot of these things, I would, even if I weren't a writer, I would be trying them out anyway.
So let's just stay with that analogy for a second, because most of us, when we do that, don't inspect the lint brush to see what they've collected.
Okay, maybe that's a bad metaphor. I'll revert to a different metaphor.
Okay.
Did you have a grandmother with an attic?
Yes.
Okay. It's more like that. Your grandmother's attic.
And you want to explore what is up there.
Well, you put stuff up there, you know, it accumulates, and
yes,
then you think, oh, I think I might need one of those. I put one up there. Let's go and see if there is one. And lo and behold, there is. You can go onto your web browser and put in New Yorker virtual reality app, because they've got a very funny YouTube video about making a virtual reality app for reading the New Yorker.
Just turning the pages.
Right. This is just like a real magazine.
So when you think of that and you do that, you're very open-minded. The curiosity brings you to many things, but also brings you to many scientific things.
Technology. I grew up with the scientists, and my older brother became one. So my childhood was spent not only reading comic books, which was the no-no thing for the kids in the 40s. That was supposed to be what was really going to corrupt you forever. So yes, we read those. And
biology was the...
The biology, I just grew up surrounded by it, but of course it made us very experimental as children. So at one point my brother and I had a mold factory. You have a look about you. I wonder if you had a mold factory as a child. You put things in jars,
I think so. Yes.
And then you put them places where other people won't disturb them, and then you come back to see what kind of mold has grown on them. And it was all different kinds of mold. So we did those kinds of experiments. We were also of the generation where you could get chemistry sets that are prohibited now because they were too dangerous. And we did kind of smoke out our mother's bridge club at one point by making the smell of rotten eggs. We didn't realize it would be quite that pungent. But we did, you know, we were just constantly doing things like that. And to me, technology is just an extension of the human impulse to investigate, explore, create with new, every time a new set of things comes along, every time a new medium comes along, or even something like the typewriter, people get very creative around it.
Why do you feel that so many people, especially as they age, become distant and concerned with the technology?
It's got something to do with the vampires. Come in at night. Suck out part of your brain.
It takes over.
I don't know why. I mean, there's a lot of quite not still very young people who are wildly experimenting and fooling around with this stuff. So I don't think it's a function of age as such. I think it's a function of openness to fooling around with new things, basically.
Mm.
Or just with things.
Bring me to the point where the bridge was produced for you with the science background to begin the writing.
Oh, you mean how come I disappointed my parents by becoming a
nice
writer
way of asking
instead
it.
Of
sure.
instead of a botanist? Yes, my dad every once in a while would shake his head and say, "You would have made such a good botanist." And if I had become one, think of what I could be doing now. Light up potatoes, you know, just all sorts of things.
And you would do that?
Of course.
Glow-in-the-dark potatoes? Sure.
How did I veer off into writing? I started doing it, and it was just more fun than anything else that I was doing. And I've always been really very admiring of my English teacher of the year before, because when they came to make a documentary on me sometime in the Dark Ages, and when she was still alive, and said to her, "Well, Margaret Atwood was in your English class, what was she like?" And ordinarily you would expect the teacher to say, "Oh, brilliant, Sean, from every pore." But she didn't say that. She said she showed no particular ability in my class. And that's true. I didn't show any particular ability in her class. I showed it the next year.
Must have been a hell of a year.
Yeah, it was quite an interesting year. I think that was the year my next English teacher said to me about one of my poems, "I can't understand this at all, dear, so it must be very good."
Do you feel that way if people don't get it, if people don't understand what you have written?
Now? Do I
yes.
feel that way?
I mean, do you worry about that?
I didn't even feel that way then, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
But I think if you're a young person writing, you have to feel that what you're writing is of interest and pretty good. And whatever you may feel about it as an adult looking back at it, at the time, it's very engrossing.
Margaret Atwood's new novel is The Heart Goes Last. It is published by Doubleday. Margaret Atwood, what a great thrill and honor to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. This edition of The Book Show is in partnership with Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts, and recorded before a live audience in the Gamble Auditorium on the campus of Mount Holyoke College. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.